Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Opening today with the latest on the efforts by East County's Iraqi Chaldean leaders to help Christians and other ethnic minorities who've been displaced from their homes by the escalating violence in Iraq. San Diego's Democratic Congressman Juan Vargas has introduced House Resolution 663, which declares an urgent need to protect religious minorities in Iraq from persecution by the Sunni Islamist insurgent and terrorist group called the Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, or ISIL, as it expands its control over areas in northwestern Iraq. Representative Vargas says that freedom of worship is a cornerstone of democracy for all Americans. He states, "We must do everything in our power to protect that right across the globe." He voices concern that ISIL is targeting Iraqi Christians and other religious minorities. "It is our job in Congress," he says, "to ensure that this issue is brought to light and that religious minorities are provided the safety and security they so desperately need. Without immediate action, thousands could be left to face violent acts in a crisis that is sure to only worsen," the congressman concludes. Iraq is currently embroiled in a political and religious insurrection stemming from an ISIL-led offensive that started in the Anbar province and has spread to locations such as Mosul, Tikrit, and Samarra, engulfing the region in violence and instability. Iraq's population is about 31 million people, and 97% identify themselves as Muslim. The other 3% are religious minorities, including Christians, Yazidis, Baha'is, Shabaks, Jews, and others. Over 500,000 people have been displaced by the current situation in Iraq, and reports have surfaced of targeted harassment, persecution, and killings of Iraqi religious minorities by ISIL, with little to no protection from the Iraqi government or other security forces. Now, Mark Arabo, a spokesman for the Iraqi Chaldean community in San Diego County, says, "We stand as witnesses to a humanitarian crisis of immense proportions within Iraq and the greater region. The plight of minorities has gone unanswered for far too long. The displaced have gone unrecognized, and the persecuted have gone without help," he says. Mr. Arabo hopes to transcend the bipartisan divide in Washington, D.C. He says he's engaged in recent dialogue with President Obama and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki concerning security issues within the country. He is calling on Congress to stand by the virtue of goodwill to assure that Iraqi minorities survive. "Change is needed to the framework of Iraq's new government," he believes, adding, "It is only here in America that we have the ability to be agents of change on a global level." The resolution introduced by Congressman Vargas reaffirms the House of Representatives' commitment to promoting and protecting religious freedom around the world and providing relief to minority groups facing persecution. In addition, it calls on the U.S. Department of State to work with the Kurdistan Regional Government, the Iraqi Central Government, neighboring countries, displaced Iraqis living in the United States, the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and other key stakeholders to help secure safe havens for those claiming amnesty. Further, it requests the addition of a special representative for religious minorities be included in Prime Minister al-Maliki's newly reconstructed government. Lastly, it urges the administration to expedite the visa processing for Iraq's minority groups and to lift the quota cap for Iraqi Christians in order to streamline the process of accepting refugees. Ben Colasso, president of the East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce, has now announced a rally for Iraqi and Syrian Christians. The rally to show support for saving lives of persecuted Christians in these countries will be held at the El Cajon City Hall on July 18th at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The recent attacks on Christians in Mosul has led to a rapid exodus of Christians from the city of Mosul to safer areas in the north of Iraq, notes Mr. Colasso, who estimates over 4,000 people, including 1,000 families, have been displaced in the last week. He says the exodus of the Christians from Mosul has been carried out in a manner of panic, and most families have not been able to take with them their personal belongings. He adds the displaced families are moving into relatives' homes in northern Iraq and are being placed in some monasteries and churches for now. Mr. Colasso concludes, "Let us all work hard to urge the free world to take immediate action and lasting measures to address this major humanitarian crisis suffered by the Christians of Iraq and Syria. A safe haven for the Christians is needed today more than ever." The local Chaldean leader has also launched a petition to U.S. representatives asking them to seriously consider creating a safe haven for Assyrians and other minorities in the Nineveh Plains, the historic homeland of Chaldeans, descendants of the ancient Babylonians of Mesopotamia.
Now you can sip a Chardonnay or a sample of Sangiovese while perusing produce and other food items at your local farmer's market. Starting immediately, a new bill signed into law by Governor Jerry Brown legalizes wine tasting at farmers' markets for winemakers. The new law opens up opportunities for dozens of wineries that have sprouted up in San Diego's East County and even more countywide. Tastes will be limited to 3 ounces per person under Assembly Bill 2488, which passed the legislature unanimously. Wine tasting must be separated from other areas at the markets by a rope or other barrier. Previously, estate-grown wines could be sold, but not sampled, at farmers' markets. The wine industry contended that this hurts sales, since customers are accustomed to trying wines before they buy. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
Welcome to Vines and Wines with your host, Greg Manis of the Manis Vineyards Estate.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, guest hosting the Vines and Wines segment. And today we are on the road in Ramona. We are here at the Hatfield Creek Vineyards with Elaine Littleton, the owner of one of Ramona's newest wineries. Elaine, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you just opened your winery about a month ago, I understand.
On lucky Friday, the 13th of June, we opened our tasting room after 8 years of planting and building.
Well, congratulations. It's a lovely tasting room. How large is this facility?
I think we're 2,300 square feet total, but that includes the cellar that's downstairs where we're winemaking.
Beautiful. Now, we have some very exciting news out of Sacramento. We just learned that Governor Jerry Brown has signed some legislation that takes effect immediately. This was passed as emergency legislation to allow wineries to do wine tasting at farmers markets. Elaine, you're also a member of the Ramona Valley Vineyards Association and the Farm Bureau for San Diego County. So can you tell us how important is this for our local winemakers and grape growers in the region?
Well, I think for Ramona, because there's so many people down the hill, as we refer to it, that don't know that Ramona has wineries or that it's an American viticultural area, I think it would be a wonderful opportunity by going to the farmers markets that are down the hill, especially weekday ones, because then it would leave the weekends available for people to be up here tasting.
Yeah, come up and discover all the wineries. How many wineries are there in the Ramona region alone now, wineries and vineyards?
I think we're pressing 100 vineyards, and I'm not sure how many wineries, but tasting rooms, we have 25 tasting rooms open. There are some wineries that are bonded, but they aren't ready yet to open tasting rooms.
Yeah, this has really exploded. When we first started the magazine back in 2008, I can recall going out to the brand new sort of tasting rooms, and it would be somebody in their garage doing serving up samples of some good wines, but it's really come along now with the boutique winery ordinance passing, and we're seeing this explosion of sort of bigger and bigger and fancier tasting rooms opening up. Still homey and rustic, but a lot more space, a lot more room. You have picnic facilities too, I understand.
Well, we're all different out here. I mean, there's some of us that have got indoor tasting rooms like we have with picnic areas, and there's some that just have tasting patios and overlooking farmyards. Mm-hmm. So it runs the gambit of the whole thing. We all are pretty conscientious about wanting to stay small and intimate and not to get too big and too commercial.
Right, we're not going to be Napa in terms of the
or
the
even
tour buses
Temecula, actually.
Yeah, it makes it a fun experience, personal experience. You come up, you meet the winemaker and
well,
talk
exactly.
With them.
And that's the most important part. Our guests that come up from down the hill just love meeting the winemaker, meeting the owners, hearing the stories about how they got into this whole crazy industry.
And now they'll be able to do that directly at the farmer's market in some cases. Now, I understand there's still a few rules to be worked out. What are some of the issues that need to be resolved here in San Diego County before the tasting begins at the markets?
Well, you still have to become, according to Eric Larson, the executive director of the Farm Bureau, who I talked to about this, we still have to be certified through the farmers markets in the county. There's a department at the county, apparently, that mm-hmm. certifies the people who go to the farmers markets.
So can you only bring your own wine, for example?
Yes.
Or can you bring other wineries, or can association bring wine?
We don't know, and the county doesn't know. I sent them an email yesterday, the gal who's in charge, and I had about half a dozen questions similar to the ones you just asked, mm-hmm. and she said that they'd get back to me, which is normal because the governor just signed the legislation, 48 hours ago or something?
Right, we're recording this on Friday.
So they need to figure out what to do with that now, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I understand there's also some limits statewide that are being set on the number of tastes, the number of pours, you know, and also making sure that it'll be a separate area. It'll be roped off for the tasting so that the miners
right.
won't have access.
Roped off area, all the usual ABC requirements of, you know, checking age requirements of the people that are there.
Sure.
And I believe it's 3 ounces per person mm-hmm. as the maximum at any farmer's market.
Farmers markets aren't the only thing that's in the pipeline here for bringing people up to Ramona. I understand that you just had a farm tour that the Farm Bureau sponsored for the first time ever. It was held in Ramona. How did that go?
Well, the farm tour day that the Farm Bureau puts on has been going on for several years, and they do it in 3 different communities, one day a year, 3 different farming communities. And Ramona had never been on the tour before, so since I'm a new Farm Bureau board member representing Ramona, I asked how come we couldn't have one up here, and they said, well, you can, let's do that. So it was a huge success, and we had a sellout crowd up here, just a huge response from the community.
So I understand it was hundreds of people came on the tour up here.
I think
this
they sold out 225 tickets up here. We had 196 people right here. because we had the picnic area for the tour.
I see.
That we had a lot of people come here and stay for a while. Mm-hmm. Oh, and we were, of course, pouring some wine for them.
Of course. The Ramona region, for listeners that may not know, actually has a federal appellation or designation as a wine-growing region now. And some of the wineries have been winning an awful lot of awards. We're over at your tasting room counter now, and Elaine, I'm seeing an awful lot of medals hanging around these bottles here.
Don't you just love the sound of bling? The only other sound that's better is a popping cork.
There you go. Tell us about some of the contests that your winery has entered. Hatfield Creek Winery has entered and won.
We entered the New York Finger Lakes International Competition, which is in the industry is a pretty prestigious
yes.
one, and they get applications from all over the world. And so we're going up against some pretty stiff competition, and we won 2 silvers and a bronze.
2 silvers and a bronze.
Yeah, we grow red wines here. We've got 1,000 Zinfandel vines and 1,000 Petite Syrah vines. So mm-hmm. we make a field blend, which is a blend of those two, and then we make the Petite Syrah and the Zinfandel separately, too.
Very good. Well, congratulations. How did you settle in on Zinfandel and Petite Syrah as the 2 grape varietals that you're specializing in here?
I had lunch one day with Francis Ford Coppola's winemaker, and he was asking us about our project and how many acres we had, and he suggested the Petite Syrah to go with the Zinfandel that I thought was my favorite and knew I wanted to plant. When I asked him why Petite Syrah, he said because they're typically blended together. The Petite Syrah adds a little body and color to Zin, mm-hmm. which might come in a little pale.
So you thought Zinfandel was your favorite until you
tried
Petite Syrah?
I didn't know anything much about Petite Syrah at all until I went to BevMo and I bought some Petite Syrah and tasted it. And then I realized that I think I really liked the Petite Syrah better, and it was probably the Petite Syrah that had been blended into Zinfandel that I had been picking up on and really liked it best. That's why. And then we make this field blend that's a perfect marriage of both those varieties right out of the field. They're fermented together and pressed together. And
okay, Syrah, Syrah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Cheers.
So cheers.
Oh, wait, now, don't break the glass.
I'm sorry. When did you first plant your vines? From the time they go into the ground to the time you start winning these awards, how long does that take?
We planted in some in 2007, some in 2008, and some in 2009. And then we started harvesting the 2007s in 2009, just mm-hmm. a very small quantity. Mm-hmm. And we were selling our grapes to the other winemakers in the valley who were a little ahead of us in the wine department. Mm-hmm. So we sold our grapes to them until we had a facility built to make our own wines.
Very good. Well, congratulations again on everything you've accomplished, Elaine. And if people wish to get more information, first of all, about the Hatfield Creek Vineyards, where would they find that?
We're HatfieldCreekVineyards.com on the Internet.
Okay.
And the Ramona Valley Wine Region magazine puts out a map that's got an all-inclusive listing of all of the wineries who have tasting rooms mm-hmm. or all who want to be listed in our map. And there's about 24, 25 on there. And we're on there.
Very good. We'll have information also up on our site in the food and wine section at eastcountymagazine.org. Do you have any other events that are coming up in the Ramona Valley wine region that listeners may want to know about?
Absolutely. We're doing our second annual Ramona Art and Wine Festival on the first Saturday in November, which is November the 1st, mm-hmm. it's held at San Diego County has two castles, and Ramona has one of them at the Mount Woodson Castle.
Oh, it's a spectacular venue.
Fabulous venue. It's very marvelous. Upscale. No cowboy boots. Sorry.
This was built by Amy Strong, who was,
She was a dress designer and costume designer for stars in Hollywood, and they would come down, and this was her dream home. Hand-built, hand-hewn, 27-room castle. It's quite a wonderful event. We've got 12 of our local wineries that'll mm-hmm. be pouring, half a dozen chefs from the area offering small bites, and about 20 artists who will be displaying. Oh, and we have a painted wine barrel auction. Ah. We've got 6 wine barrels we'll be auctioning off.
Wonderful. Where can people get more information about that event if they wish to attend or get more information?
The website for the festival is the RamonaArtAndWineFest.net, or since it's a benefit for the Ramona Heart Mural Project, you can find information too through RamonaMurals.com.
Well, thank you so much, Elaine, for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Cheers.
Cheers.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
Grossmont Hospital is mourning the loss of its chief executive officer, Michelle Tarbett, who passed away Friday morning at her home, surrounded by her family members under the care of Grossmont's hospice team. An announcement issued jointly by Sharp Healthcare and Sharp Grossmont Hospital voiced a heavy heart and great sadness at this news. Fortunately, the statement read, Michelle has left an indelible mark on Sharp Healthcare, Grossmont Hospital, the East County, and the countless individuals she worked with and knew. Barry Jantz, the CEO of Sharp Healthcare District, praised Tarbett's efforts in support of the successful passage of Prop G and for major new construction projects at the hospital. Barry Jantz, CEO of the Sharp Healthcare District, praised Tarbett's efforts in support of the successful passage of Prop G and for major new construction projects at the hospital. Michelle will be missed by us all, he added. On her Facebook page, Denise Millage observed, Michelle's legacy will live on in all she did at Sharp Grossmont Hospital, in all she touched throughout the years, and especially in her children. Tarbett, a registered nurse, expressed her own philosophy toward patient care on her LinkedIn page, where she wrote, We treat everyone the way we would want our loved ones treated. She had served as the hospital's senior vice president and chief executive officer since 1996. Under her leadership in 2011, the hospital was redesignated with Nursing Magnet Recognition, the highest nursing honor, by the American Nurses Credentialing Center. As part of Sharp Healthcare, Grossmont shared in the honor of being selected as a 2007 Malcolm Baldrige Award recipient, the highest presidential honor for quality and organizational excellence in the United States. Michelle was also the driving force behind the purchase of 2 hospice houses to serve the terminally ill. She was instrumental in formation of a capital campaign to build a new 5-story emergency and critical care center, and she helped raise funds for additional projects, including a new heart and vascular center. Tarbert was also active in charitable causes. She served as chair of the Boys and Girls Club of East County and the East County Chamber of Commerce. In addition, she served as a member of the La Mesa Rotary Club and La Mesa Park and Recreation Foundation Board. She was awarded the YMCA Tribute to Women and Industry Twin Award. She was also honored with the Council on Community Clinics Hero Award and the East County Chamber of Commerce's Women in Leadership Award. To honor her memory with a legacy that will continue helping patients in the future, a Michelle Tarbert Memorial Fund is being established by the Grossmont Hospital Foundation to benefit Sharp's Hospice Care Program, the very program that brought comfort to Michelle and her family in her final days. According to the announcement from the hospital and Sharp Healthcare, Michelle's passing was peaceful, and she left this world with dignity and grace. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson with a public service announcement from the City of El Cajon. El Cajon has extended the application period to fill two vacancies on the city's Veterans Commission. The new deadline is August 4th at 5:30 p.m. Interviews for both commissioner openings will be conducted on August 12th at 3 p.m. in council chambers at 200 Civic Center Way in El Cajon. The Veterans Commission serves in an advisory capacity to the City Council and the City Manager. In addition, the Commission makes recommendations to the City Council and the City Manager with respect to military veteran-related issues, ceremonies, events, and activities that occur within the city. Provides a forum for discussion of issues related to military veterans. It also provides advice and assistance to city residents when requested regarding services available to veterans, spouses, and dependents. And it also acts as a conduit of communication and coordination between the local military veteran community and the City of El Cajon. The commission meets quarterly or as needed. One of the vacancies fills the seat for commissioners whose term expires January 31st, 2015. The other expires January 31st, 2017. Both applicants must be a resident in the City of El Cajon. There are specific applications for each seat. The first must have been honorably discharged from the U.S. Armed Forces, but need not be a member of a veterans organization in El Cajon. The second must have been in active service or reservist within the past 10 years and must be an active member of one of the following veterans groups: American Legion Post 303, Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 2275, Navy Fleet Reserve Association Branch 47, AMVETS Post 17, or Marine Corps League Detachment Post 1032. Applications are available in the City Clerk's office or online at www.cityofelcajon.us under the What's New section of the homepage or on the Veterans Commission page. You can also call the City Clerk's office at 619-441-1763.
This is Janice Russell. I'm at the El Cajon City Council meeting on July 7th. The City Council is hearing a proposal to build a new Marriott Hotel in downtown El Cajon. The Council originally considered tearing down the East County Performing Arts Center to build a hotel on that site. But after the community voiced support to keeping the theater, the city voted to instead restore the theater and build the hotel at a different location, where City Hall, the police station, courts, and miscellaneous retail and service uses surround it. The proposed hotel will be 4 stories and will also include a community center, retail, and food service with a license to serve alcohol. The first speaker is Neil Patel from XL Hotel Group and Bob Tuttle from RF Tuttle and Associates, both of whom have partnered with the city in building the hotel. Mayor Wells praised the project.
I want to tell you personally that I was very impressed with the drawings and renderings that you provided, and I think everybody here wants to tell you how excited they are about this project.
Well, thank you, Mayor, Council.
First, Neil Patel talked about the El Cajon Courtyards and how it has a strong affiliation to business travelers and leisure guests.
I think it'll do very well in this type of community based on the Santee Sports Complex plus all the local businesses in East County. And when we were presented this opportunity, you know, several months ago, we jumped at the opportunity.
First, because they thought it was a good investment.
Also because my family, grew up in East County. So we know this area very well. We grew up in Rancho San Diego, so we have a strong affiliation to this community and proud of the opportunity.
As far as I'm concerned, you are coming at a great time, both for us and I think for you.
Mayor Bill Wills explained that El Cajon is in the middle of a renaissance right now.
We're seeing more businesses come to El Cajon than we've probably ever seen before. There's an excitement in the air.
Mayor Wills tells Patel that El Cajon is becoming one of the main places for family-friendly, community-type involvement.
Right now, I think that you'll find that this is a good place to do business, and we're certainly looking forward to a long partnership and relationship.
I agree with 100%. We do a lot of businesses in development in other cities outside of California as well. We do work in Austin and San Jose, and I can tell you that working with the city of El Cajon has been nothing but great things. They're very easy, good people to work with, expedites the process. I think together we'll be a good team.
My name is Bob Tuttle. I'm the architect, and I just wanted to reiterate a couple things Neil mentioned, that it's a pleasure to work with the city and with the city staff. It's a breath of fresh air compared with many of the other communities that we typically work in. So, again, thank you very much, and we're looking forward to a great project. So, thank you.
Nobody spoke in opposition to the project.
By a 4-0 vote, with Councilman Tony Ambrose absent, the council voted to move forward with the hotel project. Next up, the developer will submit the final architectural plans. Once permits are approved, existing buildings will be demolished, and construction will begin, with the project slated for completion in 2015.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. My very special guest today is Lenore Perez, and she is the Artistic Projects Manager for the San Diego Symphony. Lenore, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you're here today to tell us about some very exciting free public concerts that the Symphony is putting on in a series called Your Song, Your Story. Tell us what that's all about and how it got started.
Sure. We're so excited. We had our first debut performance of Your Song, Your Story. It was made possible by a generous grant from the Irvine Foundation. 2 years ago, we started the process of collecting songs, stories, and dances from San Diego's diverse communities. We got a total of 320 of those and created an original composition from that.
Wonderful. And then I understand that you're going out to some of these diverse communities and disadvantaged communities specifically for these performances. And I have a list of where they're going to be. First one, of course, already happened at the Jacobs Music Center. The next one is going to be on Tuesday, July 15th at the Joan Kroc Theater, which is right here, just one block east of La Mesa University. The next one will be Wednesday, July 16th, down at the Embarcadero Marina Park in San Diego. And the last one will be on Thursday, July 17th at Lincoln High School.
That's correct, and we're very, very excited to be able to offer this programming for free to anyone who's interested in participating. And what's even greater than that is that they get to come an hour and a half ahead of time and enjoy in the block party that will provide free food and entertainment for all.
Well, that sounds marvelous. Now, the entertainers include people from all over, and I see on the list that we have some groups I recognize from East County. That includes the Kumeyaay Youth Bird Singers from our Native American community and also the Soaring Eagles, Louie Youssef of St. Peter's Chaldean Catholic Church. There's the Martin Luther King Jr. Community Choir, and then there's a lot of others, all different kinds of dance and vocal. And tell us what else.
Well, you know, I would like to say that the Symphony is very well aware that there are many communities that do not come to the Symphony, either because it's cost prohibitive or too far away, or maybe they're not as interested in symphonic music as the Symphony would like it to these communities to be. So we have spent the last year in collecting these videos, getting to know those communities better, including your wonderful East County community, and finding ways to make it possible, you know, for them to come and for us to support their expression of their cultural song, stories, and dances.
Wonderful idea.
So one of the exciting finds we had was the Chaldean community here in El Cajon. Mm-hmm. It was so interesting to find one of the people on our committee is a military veteran.
Really?
And he stated that there are about 47,000 military veterans in San Diego County, mm-hmm. and there are as many refugees, Chaldeans, here in El Cajon. Yet they're somewhat hidden away from the people who do not live in East County, and it was a wonderful way to integrate them and bring them out to the Symphony and introduce them to a larger community in San Diego.
Well, marvelous. I know that they have some wonderful musical talents out there. I've heard some of their choral performances and things. So that's a wonderful way to bring them in to the symphony.
Yes, I was very fortunate to meet Louie Youssef, who's actually the musical director for St. Peter's Church and very popular in the community. Mm-hmm. He has his own band. And he submitted a few videos, of which Bill Conti decided to pick one.
Yeah, now Bill Conti, let's talk about him for a moment. What you did was you took all of these different videos and performances and original compositions that people from all over the San Diego community submitted, and then you went to Bill Conti, who is an Academy Award-winning artist, and you asked him to create an orchestral score from it.
That is correct. It was a big job because, as you know, these different forms are very different. The styles are very different, and, you know, they have cultural meaning. So it's you have to be very delicate about how you take this music and integrate the symphony piece without violating any of that special meaning and expression mm-hmm. that these communities have. In addition to that, you have to integrate live performers and some of the video that was submitted originally. That was a big job. But if anybody could do this, Bill Conti is the man. He is a film composer.
Listeners, if his name sounds familiar to you, he wrote, among other things, the score for the movie Rocky, the James Bond movies, some of them. What else?
Well, he's also done television, the Dynasty television show. He's done that theme.
With John Forsythe.
Cagney and Lacey, the Olympics theme. The list is very, very long. He's been around for many years, very respected, and perhaps not known by name, but you know his work. You hear it all the time and everywhere. So we were so honored to have him take on this work, this challenge of integrating all of these song stories and dances, and he did a beautiful job. Mm-hmm. There was a review written on the production last night. We were honored to have Jim Shute from the UT there. And what's important to note is that, again, it was that finding that delicate balance of supporting the expression of this art without necessarily overstepping into that art and changing it necessarily. Right. So it was wonderful, and we hope that more people will come to the performances next week. We had a whole mm-hmm. full house last night. I was very surprised as I was driving in. It was still
fabulous. I worked for the symphony myself many years ago, back mm-hmm. in the era when they were teetering on bankruptcy, just before they got the wonderful symphony hall that was built with a big donation back then. So it's marvelous to see them sort of surging back to life and keeping symphonic music alive and bringing it forth to reflect the community and, you know, the different cultural values that we have today. It's not all just Mozart or something that was written hundreds of years ago anymore.
You know, what's interesting is we did get a bunch of emails this morning from different people who were there. One who said he had been at the symphony, but his family had not, and he thought this was a good way to introduce his family to the mm-hmm. symphony. They found it really a wonderful experience and really felt validated by the symphony because this person's culture was being recognized. But he also said that he and his wife were now going to look at the symphony calendar and pick a few of the regular symphonic concerts to attend.
Marvelous.
And then he said the symphony is now part of our family. So, you know, it's an interesting way to introduce a different kind of music to a different community.
Well, you know, years ago, the symphony used to come do performances out at the East County Performing Arts Center, which it's been said has the finest acoustics of any theater in San Diego County, or did at that time. They're getting ready to reopen it next year. Do you think we might see the symphony come back out there again, maybe with performances like this one?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I actually called them to see if we can come out and perform one of the four performances that we were going to do for this production. Mm-hmm. And I learned that you were closed and in the middle of renovation. So had you been open, we would have been there for sure.
Yeah. Oh, well, wonderful. Well, we hope when El Cajon gets it back open next year, as promised, that we'll be able to come out and see and review some symphony concerts out there at that time.
Well, it is, again, a grant-funded project, so we're hoping to apply for another grant or find the funds to make it possible for the symphony to travel outside of its normal venue.
Marvelous. Listeners, if you didn't catch all the dates and times of these performances, we are going to be posting those today on our website. You can find them at eastcountymagazine.org in our Arts and Music section. Thank you so much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you, and I just want to emphasize it's free. Both attending the concert is free, and there is a pre-concert reception block party with food and entertainment, so I encourage everyone to come out.
Well, wonderful. I'm definitely planning to be there, and maybe we'll see some of our listeners out there as well.
Thank you.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
The San Diego Sheriff's Department has announced the arrest of an arsonist suspected of starting the Cocos Fire in San Marcos, which destroyed 40 homes and charred nearly 2,000 acres in May, spreading swiftly due to high winds and hot, dry weather conditions. A juvenile is in custody for the crime. There is no information linking the suspect to any other fires, according to a press release issued by the sheriff. No other information is being released at this time since the case has been submitted to the district attorney's office for review. The investigation was a cooperative effort involving the Joint Arson Task Force, Sheriff's Bomb Arson Unit, CAL FIRE, San Marcos Fire Department, and the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
At least 621 people in 29 states have been sickened by a salmonella outbreak linked to Foster Farms chickens. The government has ordered a shutdown of one of the company's facilities in California, and a voluntary recall has been issued. The outbreak has gone on for 16 months, but the company did not agree to recall most products until early July. The outbreak includes 7 strains of a drug-resistant form of salmonella that makes infections hard to treat. Almost 40% of the victims have been hospitalized, and 13% developed serious bloodstream infections, NBC News reports. The chickens have also been sold at many major outlets, including large grocery store chains and military bases. The recalled products include fresh chicken products sold by retailers under Foster Farms or private label brand names, with varying use or freeze by dates ranging from March 16th through March 31st of 2014, and frozen Sunland chicken products with best by dates from March 7th through March 11th, 2015. Before that, back in January, a Foster's farm was briefly closed down after government inspectors found cockroaches in the facility, which can spread bacteria. The company has claimed that products are safe if handled effectively, meaning keeping surfaces used for cooking and preparation clean and thoroughly cooking the chicken products. But as illnesses mount, calls for greater accountability are mounting. So Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro and Louise Slaughter are now asking the U.S. Department of Agriculture to close down all Foster Farms facilities until the health issues are resolved. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Are the roses and other garden plants you've purchased recently killing off bees and butterflies? A new study finds that half of all garden plants sold at big box stores such as Walmart and Home Depot contain neonicotinoids. Those are pesticides that are toxic to bees and other pollinating insects. The study was conducted by the Pesticide Research Institute and by the environmental group Friends of the Earth. Most home gardeners have no idea that the plants they're buying are laced with poisons that kill bees, which carry the pollen from the poison-laden plants back to the hives. Stores are not required to put warning labels on plants, so consumers have no way to even know if the plants have been sprayed with the toxins, which can linger for many months. But now, some retailers are taking steps to help protect bees and other beneficial insects. BJ's Wholesale Club says it aims to sell plants soon that are neonicotinoid-free. Home Depot hasn't gone that far, but will require that all plants sprayed with these pesticides be labeled by the end of this year, giving consumers a choice on what to buy or not buy. While the pesticides can help control unwanted pests, such as whiteflies, they aren't selective, also killing bees that farmers rely on to pollinate crops. The agribusiness industry has tried to claim that more studies are needed and that bees don't consume these poisonous flowers, only the nectar and the pollen. But Tim Brown, one of the study's authors, debunks that notion, stating that when pesticides are in the plant's tissues, it's in the pollen and the nectar, too. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The state of California is considering making water conservation mandatory, with penalties for those who fail to comply. It's been 7 months since Governor Jerry Brown asked all Californians to voluntarily reduce water use by 20%. Statewide, Californians have trimmed water use by 5%, less than requested. But in San Diego, it's even worse. Local consumers and businesses actually increased their water use by 10% over the same months last year. That's partly because San Diegans have already been asked to reduce their use by 20% as the drought has deepened over the past several years. Hotter, drier weather than usual leads to more water consumption to irrigate trees, lawns, and other landscaping. In fact, the last 6 months have seen the highest temperatures ever recorded in San Diego County during this season, the National Weather Service reports. Reservoirs are running low across California. So at its July 15th board meeting, the California Water Resources Control Board will consider adopting statewide emergency regulations, including hefty fines for those who don't comply. These could include restrictions on washing cars and limiting hours for watering lawns or other landscaping. If approved, the emergency regulations would likely take effect on August 1st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, from the desert to the coast.
This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Working hard to bring you the wildest jobs in East County. Today, Cody and I went to Lakeside. There we met a man who's going to explain why his workday is more interesting than yours, or at least more likely to end up in a trip, to the hospital.
I'm here today with Kevin Higley, who is a rodeo clown. Kevin, how long have you been doing rodeo clowning?
Ooh. That's a dated question, huh? You're going to make me tell how old I am is what you're trying to get at, right? No, I've been actually a professional rodeo clown for 30 years. Prior to that, I participated in high school rodeo and as a contestant, and then I started doing what we call amateur rodeos as a rodeo clown bullfighter, and then I got my pro card and went on to the professional ranks, and so I've been it for, I bet you, total almost 35 years.
So you were doing professional rodeo as what, prior to doing the clown part of it?
I was. I tried to be a bull rider. Thought maybe I could make a profession out of it and a living. Wasn't very good at that. So what it came to be was my brother was a really good bull rider, and we had what they call a practice pen at home where we buck some bulls and stuff. And so we took turns being the bull fighter who would save the bull rider. Well, boy, I saved him a whole lot more than he ever thought of saving me. And so it became apparent that I was probably a little bit more adapted to the bullfighting area and saving the cowboys. And that was really the love and passion that I had once I got started, that, you know, the thrill of saving a guy so you can get on to another one is really something else. And as time went on, of course, you slow down a couple steps. Not me, but my mind may. I don't know. But anyway, so then I transferred into the rodeo clown / barrel man type aspect of the professional rodeo deal.
Now, you use the term bull fighting, which seems more appropriate to me somehow. So here's another question for you. I've noticed that bulls don't seem to have a lot of sense of humor. So have you actually made one ever laugh?
Oh, yeah, they're always smiling when they run over you. Yeah, well, they've got a smile. You know, a lot of people, they used to say that a bull will actually close his eyes before he runs over you. But that's not true. I can attest to that. They're wide open, and they are laughing. It's like, I got you, buddy. It's good.
So the natural follow-up to that is, how many bones have you had broken?
That's one we don't like to discuss very much. But, you know, I've been really fortunate in my career to stay away from most of the broken bones. I fractured a couple neck vertebrae, and I've had a couple of bones in my foot broke and a couple things like that. But as a whole, I've been really healthy and really good.
Do you really like to use the word whole when you're talking about bulls and horns and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's kind of, you got to watch that one. Put you in a hole.
Now, I'm sure that people, not necessarily associated with rodeo, but people on the outside probably think that you would do this for the thrills. What kind of satisfaction do you get from actually doing this work?
That's a great question. You know, like I said early on, is just the satisfaction that you've did something to help somebody else to be able to further their career and go on and stuff. So saving a bull rider from a bull, or helping him, assisting him to be a higher score, that's where it starts. And that now it's the thrill of entertainment, you know, making people laugh. I just love to hear them giggle and laugh. And so that part is where I'm at now in my career. So we do it for the love, because, you know, unlike a lot of professional sports, the money isn't probably as good as your football, your baseball, your basketball players. But it also is an aspect of it. We do it for the money as well.
Yeah, so you're as a professional rodeo, I see that you have a big trailer. So you travel around from rodeo to rodeo?
I do. Throughout the course of this year, I'll probably be in at least 15 states. I guess the farthest away, which my trailer wasn't able to go with me and a lot of my animals wasn't, was Hawaii. We've actually did rodeos in Hawaii on two of the islands over there.
Oh, really? So you did go to Hawaii, but you just didn't float your trailer across?
No, trailer stayed home, as well as my animals that I use in my clown acts, yeah.
Okay, so you do an act out on the in the arena with your own animals. I see you have a dog over there. Is that one of your?
Yeah, I've actually got three or four dogs, and I've got a trick horse, trick mule. You know, sometimes the kids become my tricks. You know, I'm very enthusiastic about getting the crowd involved, and so we use the kids a lot of times in some of the things we do.
If I ever were to find myself in a field with a pissed off bull, because, you know, that happens to me a lot, give me some ideas for how to sort of distract the guy.
Well, you know, so the best thing to do is, of course, it's not all about how fast you can outrun them. It's about the move that you can make to get around them. Because they've got a big old body, and they got to bend in half to get to back to where you are. So what you want to do is you want to kind of get in as close as possible and then make that move to the inside and keep them coming. And then when you get to break, you break them so they're on a different lead and you can get away from them.
So you have to fight every instinct, natural instinct, to turn around and run. You have to get close to them, right next to them, in order to be safe.
You're sure better off. Yeah, you're better off. I mean, I know that my legs have never stood around for my face to take a beating, you know. And so it's kind of a natural instinct to run, yes. But, you know, there's a lot of different things you use. The apparel that we wear, the things we wear that gets their attention, that will bring them in your direction, and then it's up to you to make the move to bring them away from the cowboy and to get yourself away.
Okay. Now, professional football players, you mentioned them. They're always complaining about having a short career. Now, you've been doing this for a while. How long would you say the average rodeo clown sort of stays in the profession?
You know, and I guess that would be a term that's kind of tough to use, average, because I don't know any of us that are too, you know. And I guess the guy that kind of I look up to and kind of was my mentor, taught me a little bit, was a guy by the name of Wick Path. And he actually fought bulls at an active level, professional level, till he was 57 years old. It's all about how physically fit you stay. We've got a guy in the business right now that's strictly entertainment. He doesn't even get in the barrel anymore or do any of those things to help out. And he's 78 years old and very active and doing a great job.
Okay, well, see, my son here is, let's say that he goes to see his guidance counselor at school, and the guidance counselor, I've noticed, doesn't have any posters on the wall of rodeos or anything.
No.
But let's say that she says that she's changed her mind and he should forget about engineering and all of that, and he should become a rodeo clown. What advice would you give him for getting into this job, apart from why don't you do something safe like join the Navy SEALs?
Yeah, there we go. Two safe jobs. Well, I'll tell you what the first thing I would do with modern day rodeo, we have schools, and the best thing to do for someone that's inspiring to be a rodeo clown or a bullfighter or a participant, a contestant, is to search out one of those schools and go spend a week, 3 days, whatever the school is, and actually get a head start on what they really could do and if they're adapted for that.
Do you know of any women who do this job who are rodeo clowns?
You know, there used to be, years ago, there was a lady that actually didn't actually do the bullfighting part of the clown, but she got in the barrel, and she would tell a few jokes and do stuff. But that was a long time ago. Right at this present time, I don't know anybody, any ladies. I think it has to do with intelligence.
Oh, okay. That's an excellent point. Cody, you have a question?
Yeah, what's the deal with the barrels? What exactly do you do with barrels?
Okay, the barrel is out there for a particular reason. We had put it out in the middle of the arena. Actually, not quite the middle of the arena. It's a little closer to the bucking chutes. And it really becomes kind of like a safe haven for the bullfighters or the bull riders. In case that bull is coming at them, they're caught out in no man's land. They can come there, catch their breath, get away, or at least the bull will be distracted so they can move on. It's my job as a barrel man to position my barrel in a place which will help assist the bullfighters and the bull rider to be able to have a little bit more safety. So, and it's really like sitting in a washing machine just waiting for somebody to turn that thing on, the spin cycle. Because when one of those guys hits it, it can really turn your world upside down.
So it sounds like your job is more about strategy than it is about, I mean, obviously on YouTube or on TV, what they like to show is rodeo clowns being tossed and trampled and all that. But the object is to avoid that and to protect the cowboys and to entertain the crowd, basically, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a given that you're going to be in a very bad situation most of the time because, you know, you've got an unpredictable animal. He's gonna do what he wants to do. He's going to do this. So you're going to be put in a position where you're going to get in there that you're probably going to get what they call hooked and thrown out of there. But the better that you prepare yourself to be able to make yourself in the right position to walk away from that, the longer your career will be.
So you're kind of like the ninjas of the West, is what you're telling me.
I never had it put that way, but yeah, cowabunga, dude, let's do it.
Yeah, Cody?
So is it true about bulls that they don't like red? Like, don't like red capes. Is that true?
Great question. You know, and it really is a myth. That doesn't have to do with the red cape that the matadors, you see if the matadors are fighting, or like in our case, we wear bandanas a lot of times on our deals. It's all about the movement. It's the movement of something that brings their attention to it. And that's why when you see the guys with the capes and the matadors, and they can stand in one spot, but the bull will follow a cape and follow that deal.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the people of East County?
Boy golly, if they get a chance, come to the rodeo. They're going to enjoy it.
So, Cody, now that you've seen a little bit of what life as a rodeo clown is like, are you ready to reconsider your future?
No, because as much as my counselors say that I should quit any field that involves thinking, I think I should steer clear of this kind of career.
Are you saying that you don't want to get involved in something that can cow you this much?
You know, I have a lot of beef with you saying something that mean about me, Dad.
Well, I would say that right now my attitude is the lasso your problems.
I just don't know if I'm capable of learning the ropes on this exciting career.
Well, son, that sounds like a lot of bull to me because I don't know anyone who clowns around as much as you do. This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Clocking out of one of the wildest jobs in East County.
This is Ed Barena for East County Magazine on KNSJ. With the threat of wildfires across multiple states, the nonprofit Federal Alliance for Safe Homes, or FLASH, offers wildfire prevention tips for residents. You can protect your home and prepare your family for wildfires. Remember, embers can be blown more than a mile from the flame, so it is critical to take action to make your home wildfire resilient. Here are some ways to prepare your family. Have a fire disaster plan, including at least 2 predetermined evacuation routes, a NOAA weather radio, and disaster kit for your family. Follow any and all evacuation orders immediately. Here are some other ways you can protect your home. Identify an emergency water supply within 1,000 feet of your home through one of the following: community water hydrant system, drafting site on a lake, cooperative emergency storage tank with neighbors, or a swimming pool. Remove fuels that can lead flames to your home or that can become ignited from windblown embers, including dead grass, leaves, and branches within 30 feet of buildings. Dry leaves and litter from roofs, rain gutters, decks, and walkways, dead and dry litter at the base of plants, tree branches within 6 to 10 feet off the ground, firewood within 30 feet of buildings, and continuous beds of combustible vegetation on the ground or in treetops that can bring large flames within 100 feet of your home. Clean your gutters, eaves, and roof to make sure they are clear of debris. Plant species that retain moisture and resist ignition, including native fire-resistant vegetation, you can check with your local forestry agency for this, fire-prone trees and shrubs away from your home and far enough apart so they won't ignite one another. Make sure your street number is legible and clearly marked for emergency responders. Move any storage sheds, including lawnmowers, grills, gas cans, and tanks, away from your home. Before a threat, landscape with fire-resistant native plant species that retain moisture and resist ignition. Install metal screening that blocks embers from entering your buildings, including non-combustible attic crawl space vents and around low decks, non-combustible skirting around mobile homes, and if under a wildfire threat, only remove dead leaves or vegetation when local garbage collection services will have time to pick up the debris. Federal Alliance for Safe Homes, or FLASH, is a nonprofit organization and is a consumer advocacy group for strengthening homes and safeguarding families from natural and man-made disasters. For more information on wildfire prevention, visit www.flash.org or www.protectyourhome.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show: Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.